Ladies and gentlemen, given our topic, the future that doesn't work, I had originally planned on speaking about Nicaragua and the Sandinist future, which didn't work, but I'm no longer so sure that it might not work because given activities by Senators Kennedy, Hart, and the distinguished Republican from Connecticut, they may have a future. Also, Dr. Silber, hearing about my plans to talk about Nicaragua, warned me that Central America is his turf and would I please stay out of it. Then he talked about something entirely different. At Boston University recently, I saw a car, a mighty big car with a license plate with a funny sign on it, I'd never seen it before, and a bumper sticker, which read, "Build ramps, not rockets." I kept wondering how you would launch rockets without ramps, but apparently I misunderstood the message. I'd like to talk about the future that doesn't work, talk about the non-nuclear future, which I think cannot work, and I would like to talk about lemmings, the non-nuclear lemmings. You notice from the composition of the panel, an Italian, a Britisher, and myself being German, we represent nations, member nations of NATO, which have deployed the Euro missiles. The Italians in Comiso, the British in Greenham Commons, and the Germans in Mutlangen, southern Germany. But also please notice, we have all left after deployment and have come to North America. The initial deployment of the so-called Euro missiles in Italy, Great Britain, and Germany can be seen as a major political setback for the Soviet Union and also for the so-called peace movement in Western Europe. The outcome of the deployment stretched over 4 years following NATO's dual-track decision in 1979 seems to demonstrate that Moscow could no longer manipulate West European public opinion the way it had in 79 when Moscow succeeded in Jimmy Carter not deploying the neutron warhead in Europe. I say it can be seen, but we need not necessarily see it that way. Well, he should be a bit more pessimistic about it. With hindsight, it should be concluded that NATO in 1979, instead of linking deployment with arms control talks in Geneva, would have been better advised to deploy right away, rather than offering to the Soviet Union a propaganda opportunity, which the Soviet Union and the peace movement have used rather successfully, in particular, I think, in causing lasting harm to NATO. And I mean lasting harm. Of course, one objection may be right away to the demand that NATO should have deployed in 79. It couldn't have done so because we had no missiles, and we have very few today. The Soviet Union has been building over the past 15, 20 years a massive military apparatus at every level. By the end of the Carter administration, the Soviet Union had built a substantive lead over the United States as a military power in all fields that matter, both nuclear and conventional. Even if the Soviet nuclear arsenal were not designed for use in nuclear war, it provides a powerful instrument of Soviet foreign policy. The Soviet buildup, most directly affecting United States ties with Western Europe and Japan, and designed to split alliances, occurred in intermediate-range nuclear weapons. By early 83, the Soviet Union had in service in its western territories more than 351 SS-20 Pioneer reloadable launchers, or ramps. The SS-20 can reach every corner of Western Europe, and when launched in the Soviet Union, eastern territories, all of China and Japan. But the most vigorous reaction in Western Europe and in North America was not directed at the Soviet Union. In the United States, it created the freeze movement, and in Europe, a rather vociferous and numerous peace movement. Rather than attacking verbally the Soviet Union, NATO's dual-track decision, and in particular, the United States of North America, became the target for countless demonstrations of the peace movement and regular protestations from Moscow. If we have a look at Europe today, at Western Europe, we have to conclude. In the Low Countries and in Scandinavia, visions of nuclear-free zones have become accepted wisdom or even policy. Norway and Denmark, also in Greece. Greece does not accept, together with the two Scandinavian countries, nuclear weapons on their territories. Denmark, in a stunning reversal of its 1979 approval of deployment, has revoked it late in 1983. Belgium and the Netherlands, projected recipients of the missiles, are right now embroiled in internal disputes, and both countries might not deploy at all. In West Germany, NATO's key member in NATO, on the continent, the long-lasting foreign policy consensus between the two major parties has collapsed. With the two leading wings of the Social Democrats, they only have two, the center and the left, with the two leading wings either advocating withdrawal from NATO or revisions of the NATO treaty regarding Germany's role. Similar developments have occurred in Britain. American demands on West Germany to augment its defense efforts within NATO coincide with West German doubts about its role in NATO and with a period of budget cuts and manpower shortages in the Bundeswehr. Internal NATO debates over the no first use and the so-called conventional option, plus denigration of NATO's key doctrines of flexible response and forward defense, are not reassuring to West Germany, which shares a 1,400-kilometer border with Warsaw Pact countries. 4 years after NATO's crucial dual-track decision, the alliance strains under quasi-neutralist temptations of several member nations. Centrifugal forces threaten NATO's cohesion at a time of growing Soviet global ambitions. Given the Soviet Union's new and very impressive military powers, capabilities for projecting military power worldwide, one should conclude that NATO's original concept as a European alliance to defend against the Soviet threat in Europe is outdated. One can also conclude that NATO will have to widen its scope, revise its strategy, and expand its operational area, or it will self-destruct. Within NATO, slogans of Hollanditis and Denmarkization are indicators of a pacifism unwilling to perceive the Soviet threat and of a parasitism unable to hide political irresponsibility behind proclaimed moral reasoning. One should also conclude that the pursuit of so-called peace is an activity not limited to members of the peace movement. Let me quote President Reagan, who said recently, I quote, "My dream is to see the day when nuclear weapons will be banished from the face of the earth." I find that a rather silly statement, because talking about a dream, making it appear that the dream can be fulfilled someday, is first of all ritualistic, secondly politically I find extremely dangerous, because the other side, I talk about the Soviet Union, certainly has no such dream. If any such dream ever became reality, one should easily conclude today that this world, nuclear-free or free of nuclear weapons, would not be a free world. American pipe dreaming about a non-nuclear world has a long history. It started, I think, about 1960. Eisenhower still was a very solid nuclear soldier and had a solid nuclear arsenal. The arsenal started to collapse with President Kennedy. By the mid-1950s, the United States had developed and produced nuclear arms designed for deployment in localized military conflicts, so-called tactical nuclear weapons, had plenty of them. One of the first major policy changes of the Kennedy administration was to reduce reliance on the new weapons and to increase reliance on conventional forces. American military doctrine adjusted quickly to the new political realities. In 1957-58, the United States Army's Command and General Staff College had 614 annual hours of instruction in nuclear weapons. 10 years later, there were only 21 hours. Let's compare again, 614 in 1958, 21 10 years later, in special weapons instruction. The term nuclear weapons instruction is no longer used. Ever since the Kennedy administration, the major U.S. planning assumption for theater nuclear forces has been that any attack by the Warsaw Pact will be non-nuclear. and will, in turn, be met by non-nuclear forces. If NATO's conventional forces are unable to contain the attack, only then, and only then, according to NATO doctrine, will the option of going nuclear be considered. Given NATO's doctrinal emphasis on conventional warfare, it is not surprising that little time is spent training for a nuclear conflict. Whatever training there is ranges from unsystematic to comical. If the Soviets shared NATO's view of the nature of the coming war in Europe, the neglect of the American armed forces would be immaterial. But the Soviets do not share that view. Soviet military literature emphasizes the tactical, rather that, tactical nuclear weapons are the principal means for the conduct of ground warfare. Soviet strategist Sidorenko writes that Warsaw Pact troops will overcome the enemy's defense, quote, not by gnawing through a narrow sector or through a solid front, as was the case in past years, but simultaneously across a broad front along axes from the march at high tempo right after nuclear strikes. Despite this and countless similar statements by other Soviet strategists, the U.S. doggedly clings to its belief that if and when the Soviets attack, they will do so by conventional means. Inevitably, tactical nuclear weaponry suffered the fate of tactical nuclear doctrine in the United States. In the mid-1950s, official Washington was receptive to a smaller, discriminate weapon. John Foster Dulles wrote in 1957, "Recent tests point to the possibility of possessing nuclear weapons, the destructiveness and radiation effects of which can be confined substantially to targets." But then came John F. Kennedy and with him Robert Strange McNamara. I quote McNamara, "Nuclear weapons, even in the lower kiloton ranges, are extremely destructive devices and hardly the preferred weapon to defend such heavily populated areas as Europe. America, under Carter, was handed the nuclear weapon fitting this very description called the Enhanced Radiation Warhead, also the neutron bomb, and as you all recall, Jimmy Carter rejected it, did not bring it to Europe, and I think triggered the present decay of NATO. The Soviets then preach what they practice. In training, nuclear warfare is of prime importance in the Red Army. For the last 20 years, they have concentrated on improving and expanding their tactical nuclear capabilities. They have worked on a neutron bomb as early as 1953. Today we know that their tactical nuclear systems are newer than those of the US, that their weapons have greater ranges and greater versatilities than the US systems. Just compare the SS-20 with the Pershing II. I mentioned that in 1979, the Pershing II does not exist. One could talk at great lengths about the lack of wisdom in offering arms control reduction talks, with an enemy who is rich in those weapons and between the United States, who, when starting negotiations in Geneva, had not one single Pershing II. It couldn't work and never will work. Right now, there is much talk about the no-first-use policy of NATO, advocated by whom else? By Robert S. McNamara and three other musketeers. They call themselves the Four Musketeers, without arms, though. No-first-use would mean NATO will under no circumstances use nuclear weapons against an attack by the Soviet Union. Robert S. McNamara has also said that nuclear weapons serve no military purpose whatever. Those declarations of one-sided, voluntary disarmament are an invitation for the Soviet Union, of course, to harden their very stance, as they do right now. What is more worrisome, then, than those statements by McNamara and a group of disarmers is that the virus of unilateral disarmament has bitten into very smart thinkers of the non-left. The current issue of Harper's Magazine contains the debate on should the United States stay with NATO and in NATO, and the most prominent member of that panel is Irving Kristol. Let me quote. He wants to leave NATO for reasons of fear. He believes that if the Russians do attack, America will be forced to use nuclear weapons, thus triggering destruction of the United States of America. He says, if we continue to have an alliance with NATO, there will have to be a limit. And the limit will be that we are not going to have a nuclear conflict to defend Western Europe. Conceding, and by so doing differing with both official Soviet propaganda and the peace movement, that, quote, there will not be a nuclear war in Western Europe unless the Russians start it, Crystal is nevertheless unwilling to think the thinkable. Quote, if the Russians use nuclear weapons first, then I have no answer to any question. Then I don't know what to do. I would do whatever my impulse moved me to do. The whole thing becomes irrational if they use nuclear weapons first. Unquote. There's, of course, nothing irrational in the whole thing, also known as Soviet war planning. Retired French General Pierre Galois, who in 1960 formulated and instituted French independent nuclear doctrine, says, and he's very explicit, the next war will not start with a tank invasion of Germany. The next war will begin with a Soviet surprise simultaneous attack with highly accurate low-yield nuclear weapons against all the military targets in Western Europe, with minimum casualties of civilians and U.S. personnel. The Soviet tanks will be used only for mopping up operations. At exactly this time, NATO is urged from within to consider the conventional option, to close a gap which has developed. But it is glaringly obvious that such a move would, one, meet with lip service only from European allies, two, play into the hands of Soviet planners contemplating a surgical first strike with nuclear arms, three, deceive the public in the West by misrepresenting Soviet war aims and planning, and four, make strategic and tactical sense only if NATO radically altered its defense posture and operational doctrine. When NATO was founded in 1949, the Soviet Union was a European power. Through three decades, NATO worked well in countering the Soviet threat. But over those 30 years, the Soviet Union evolved into a global power, expanding into Southeast Asia, the whole of Africa, Central America, and into the Five Oceans, thus actively threatening all NATO members as their jugular, the sources and arteries of raw material. Yet NATO European members, plus Japan and Canada, have ignored the threat, deftly leaving the defense of the sea lanes, that is, of their economies, to the U.S. The consequence, as was to be expected, are demands on North America for withdrawal from Europe. One can say that given the Soviet Union's new capabilities for projecting power, NATO will have to change. Will it? One should have one's doubts. The Soviet SS-20, aside from threatening all of Western Europe physically, are primarily tools of political intimidation and blackmail, designed and deployed to eventually decouple the United States from Europe. It is up to Western Europe to reject the Pax Sovietica looming over the horizon. Yet, when listening to good thinkers, normally good thinkers like Irving Kristol, one has one's doubts about the West's resolve to do anything productive. How could this all come about? There is a conclusion written many years ago by a leading Soviet war planner, Marshal Sokolovsky, who wrote a big primer called Soviet Military Strategy. Let me quote from this book, written in 1964 through 1968. Didn't talk about the SS-20, which by then didn't exist. He says, nuclear missiles are not meant to affect the adversary's physical strength. They are meant to undermine his spirit, his mind, and his will. Thank you.
Thank you very much.